Hello again, thank you for welcoming me in your consciousness and leaving the door open for me. So now that I'm here, I will of course indulge you with existential topics. And I do this together with Sheldon Solomon, who I will invite into your mind as well in a minute. And in this second part of the interview, we go into fundamentalism, racism, sustainability, other topics that might give you a headache. And we will look at it from the angle of death. So, very cozy chat. So, I look forward to hearing your feedback about this. And yeah, I want to make this a bit more professional. So, if you like it, please share it with people so the word can get out. And you can also do a good donation on 20angles.com if your financial situation allows it. Of course, thank you very much. And hear you later.
Yeah, it's definitely not in their interest that people just become more aware of their irrationality and people stop to pause and think, why am I doing this? Is there maybe some fear inside me, or do I have some avoidance behavior? Because I also think when we talk about the debt that's upon all of us, is that we all have different strategies to cope with it. I think maybe some extreme of that is the religious fundamentalism, because that's the real, like, denying. That's the denying strategy. If we only do this and this, then we will not die and we will have 20 virgins in the afterlife.
Yep, and I like that. I'm on the waiting list for that form of heaven. Equally potent is economic fundamentalism. So you've got the religious fundamentalists saying, you know, I know that the mm-hmm. life after this is going to be better than this one. And then you've got the economic fundamentalists who, British philosopher John Gray, he just says that that's secularized Christianity, because they have this idea that we can have life on earth like it is in heaven if we just mm-hmm. let everybody be selfish and let the invisible hand of the marketplace work its magic. But that's a ridiculous delusion for which there's no empirical evidence. And so we're no more likely to wake up one day in heaven as it is presented to us by the fundamentalists, as we are by heaven on earth as it is presented to us by the neoliberal economists.
Yeah, I think the whole neoliberalism, it's a difficult word for a non-native speaker. it doesn't agree with, like, the research on how people intrinsically are made to collaborate, and how we have like this oxytocin and other.
Yep.
Other hormones. So, it's not a very evidence-based theory, I think.
No, you're quite right. So, you know, all of the neoclassical economics, the way I see it, is all derived from John Locke's ideas about the virtue of selfishness and mm-hmm. the fact that we need to parlay our innate selfishness into prosperity. Mm-hmm. But Locke at least has the integrity to say that if his assumptions about human nature are wrong, then his entire political philosophy is called into question. And my point mm-hmm. is that his assumptions about human nature are wrong. And people who support his economic views, which in our country would be all Republicans, in most other countries it would be conservatives, they don't seriously go back and wonder about what an economy would look like if we had a more appropriate depiction of human nature, which is that we are and can be very selfish, but we're also, as mm-hmm. you put it a moment ago, Stephen, we're naturally pro-social. We are
the question is, are we made to be good, or like are we intrinsically good, or are we intrinsically bad? And I think a lot of research neurobiology or otherwise, so shows that we are intrinsically made to collaborate
Good.
with other
And
people.
we can be bad and evil, but we are intrinsic collaborators, especially in situations where we perceive noble intent and reciprocation. So even babies, long before they can walk, little babies at like 14 months old, if somebody helps them, then they will likely help that person in return. Moreover, and more impressive, in these very clever laboratory paradigms, if somebody tries to help a baby, but they're unsuccessful, like a baby's reaching for a toy, and somebody tries to give it to them, but in the process of trying to do that, drops it, little babies will reciprocate. Even though they weren't given the toy, they recognize benevolent intentions on somebody else's part and will respond appropriately. So not only are we prepared to collaborate and reciprocate, we also very early on recognize and react to good intentions. And these are the evolutionary qualities that we need to make ourselves and other people more explicitly aware of. And we need to exploit those to everybody else's goodwill. See, right now, what I see for the most part are people saying people are selfish, they're not going to change. So let's use that as the basis for structuring the entire economy. And of course, in so doing, we've put ourselves in a situation where we're about to destroy the earth because the neoclassical economy is based on a consistent growth. That's only good for malignant tumors and compound interest.
And we don't have indefinite resources
No, we
as well,
don't.
so.
And so this is madness if you build a system where you parlay human selfishness and death anxiety into making that noble and virtuous. Why not make noble and virtuous what the ancient Greeks thought? And that is our tendency to collaborate with our fellow humans in the service of making things better for everybody. I find that a much more uplifting view that is no
Yeah, and
less
also think
anchored.
like wealth is not a zero-sum game, eh? Wealth can be there can be wealth for everybody as long as it's well guided and it's ethical, and some people don't have the extreme outcomes whilst others have the least. But yeah,
Yep,
I
well
think
put.
status is a zero-sum game. So people like companies like to have these status things and these hierarchy things,
Yep.
but that by itself, if one person has a status, it implies that another person must have a lower status.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think that's in the end what's also behind this whole selfish image of human beings, of humanity is because people like to keep that status image and that hierarchy. Don't know if I said it very well. It's a
No,
bit
you said
confusing.
it very, very well, and I believe you're absolutely correct. Or to put it more humbly, I agree with you. I think that when we look at everybody needs to feel good about themselves. We need to feel like we're persons of value in a meaningful universe. But when the sole measure of those needs is where we stand on a hierarchical continuum, where only one person can be number one, and where anything below number one is a failure, well, that's a recipe for psychological despair. And there are other ways to structure our social behavior, where we can still strive for excellence in a way that provides everybody with opportunities to feel meaningful and valuable.
Yeah, I think as that's also one of the obvious things in our life that we don't question. As long as we think that the truth is that life is a hierarchy, and life is the way it is. And if you work hard, one day you will be the boss, and then you can be maybe a bit less ethical to other people. If you think that's life, then
That's
I
right.
think the world will never change, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Yeah, what I find interesting about, like, when we talk about that we are afraid of dying, it's kind of irrational, I think, like all fears, but because if we are dead, we don't feel it. Like, there's nobody to experience that. So if the lights go out, there's nobody noticing it anyway. So it's a bit weird that we are so afraid of it, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. That view goes way back to Epicurus and Lucretius. So this
I
is,
read that in your book,
yeah,
yeah.
and I love that. I love it because I agree, but I also see why no one's ever believed it throughout human history for the most part. Because again, it asks us to be reasonable. So the argument is nobody worries about the millions of years that happened before you were alive, and you're not going to be aware of anything when you're dead. Yeah, so how come we spend our lives being preoccupied by the prospect of our death? And the answer, very simply, is because that would be rational, but we're not fundamentally rational creatures.
No, we aren't. It would be like, if I would die, I would be okay with it because I'm not there, but it would be horrible, at least I assume, for my girlfriend and for my family. So I think that's where the real damage is. But for me dying myself, not that I want to die, but I think, yeah, if I die, I die. Yeah.
But yeah, and I think that's true for lots of folks. But what we do know research-wise is that death is a complex, multidimensional concept, and people's anxieties about it vary. So some people like you, and I'd like to think for myself, are concerned about the implications of us dying for the people that we care about. Other people are just concerned about their physical carcass. They really have a problem with the idea that they're going to die and that they're going to start rotting and stinking and worms are going to crawl out of their nose.
Yeah, I
Other
had that
people,
vision in childhood as well.
me
It
too.
scared the shit out of
Me
me.
too. So I have that long standing. And then other folks, the narcissists of the world, are just concerned about if somebody's going to remember them. So lots of different ways to be afraid of death and lots of variation in terms of what concerns people most.
I think the narcissism is interesting because I've met some, I think, narcissists already, like in professional experience. But like, what they say a lot about narcissists is that there's deep inside, there's some really, let's call it low self-esteem, or maybe that's not the right word,
No,
but
it is right.
some deep insecurity or fear, or what's your opinion about that?
Oh, absolutely. So I say this with confidence because there's a substantial empirical literature. But way back, people like Karen Horney, who I alluded to earlier in a book called Neurosis and Human Growth, point out
I have to
that,
read that book, I think.
yeah, it's a fine book because she makes a distinction between genuine self-esteem and narcissistic self-inflation. And her point is that narcissists appear superficially self-confident. And in fact, if you measure their self-esteem, they score the highest on self-esteem. But that's because they're legends in their own mind. And you can measure self-esteem both consciously and unconsciously. And some people have high self-esteem no matter how you measure it, but narcissists have high self-esteem if you measure it consciously, and really low self-esteem if you measure it unconsciously. And so basically, their high veneer of self-esteem is just a defensive manifestation of an underlying massive insecurity. So they're actually just a bouillabaisse of psychological insecurity.
Yeah, I think like they're, I think they're, so a lot of narcissists, like deep inside, they're running around like a chicken without a head. They have something that is so important to them and is always present in their mind that they just go bananas on their environment, I think. And do you
Yes.
think that that might be the fact that they will die, that something has to do with them being narcissistic, or?
Well, we do. I mean, that you know, maybe not surprisingly, given our work, we think death anxieties are plausibly connected to everything. And of course, that's either profound or true, but trite. You know, so some people say, well, look, if you're saying death anxiety influences everything, yeah, that's a meaningless statement. Our point is it does, but it does so in very different ways. And we would argue that narcissists are riddled with anxieties, and that a lot of them have to do with concerns about dying. So I was writing and talking about Donald Trump in the 1990s, and I used him as a great example of somebody completely overwhelmed with death anxiety, and hence his need to always be surrounded by beautiful women, to put his name on buildings and airplanes and steaks and vodka bottles. And, you know, at the time I was just like, oh, this is sad. Now I'm like, oh, wow, this is the most dangerous guy in the history of Earth, not because of his malignant narcissism, you know, combined with his paranoia and the fact that he's a psychopath, but he would always be that. But, you know, an annoyance in the business world becomes a mortal threat to humanity once he or she assumes the position of the president of the United States.
Yeah, I think in term, like, when we go more philosophical about our sense of self, we just create a feeling of having a constant me, just because it makes us feel more secure about a very insecure future, I think.
That's right.
I always find like self-esteem a very weird word, or like related to it, like self-confidence, because you need to have some measuring scale,
yes,
in order to grade yourself from 0 to 10. But then the question is, how do people get this measuring scale from for themselves?
Well, a great question. So back in the day, before you were born, a lot of people in the U.S., we read these books by Carlos Castaneda. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. You might
no,
like
I
it.
Haven't.
So he was a guy who pretended to be an anthropologist, and he said he was studying native populations in Mexico and South America that used hallucinogens in order to become self-realized. And I like his books a lot, even though it turns out that the guy was a fraud and he never left his house in Los Angeles. Mm. But his character, Don Juan, who was the wise guy, he one of his quotes was, "The average person seeks approval in the eyes of others and calls it self-confidence, whereas the warrior seeks approval in their own eyes and calls it humility." And I think that's the critical question. Self-esteem, I think, is of critical importance, but what makes it complicated is that some people gain self-esteem solely by adhering to somebody else's standards, whereas some of us, like to think I've gotten there sometimes, we measure ourselves in terms of our own intrinsic barometers of what it means to be good. And I think the trick is, I think we do it both ways. But at our best, I think we measure ourselves by our own internal standards. And that gets us away from the narcissistic tendency to always have to be better than those around us. And I think that's a good way to think about things.
Yeah. And then probably the person's environment, also the genetics, the environment in which they grew up, it makes them choose between either these intrinsic
that's right
way of scoring themselves, or the more extrinsic, more narcissistic way of saying how good they are in relationship to the world and other people.
That's right.
Do you think it's also because of or need for self-esteem, maybe because to feel more secure about ourselves and our very fragile condition? Do you think that's also something that might be causing racism in
Absolutely.
people?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I say it with some confidence based on a vast empirical literature. The lazy way of getting self-esteem and is to disparage others. Virginia Woolf
Or
in the
just
ninth.
to make other people slaves because they
That's
have a
correct.
different
Yeah.
color.
That's right. Virginia Woolf called it the looking glass self. And what she said is that, there's two ways of having self-esteem. One is to actually do something that you can be sincerely proud of. And the other is to use people as a way to magnify yourself. So she's like, oh, if you look at the people through a magnifying glass, if you turn it one way, they get bigger. If you turn the glass the other way, it makes people look small. And her point as a metaphor is that, most people sadly make themselves enlarged psychologically by diminishing the stature of those around us.
It's funny that almost all the weirder automatic behaviors we have has something to do with that we cannot accept uncertainty and we try to predict and plan, I think, all our entire life. And we think if we only plan enough and think about things enough, things will turn out right, and I will be happy. But maybe the opposite would be better, is to sometimes visualize how things would go wrong and how you might lose people maybe tomorrow that you love. It might give you better appreciation about life, because in the end, is there then a good way to look at this debt that we will all face one day and maybe use it to our advantage in our life?
Yeah, so Stephen, I think you've come to the crux of the issue from our perspective psychodynamically, and that is that death anxiety is not going to go away. And a case could be made that it shouldn't. If you weren't anxious about dying, you would have been systematically removed from the gene pool eons ago. And of late, I've been reading Martin Heidegger's work, The Philosopher. I ignored it for decades because it's hard and he's a Nazi. But then I'm like, all right, Nazis are people too. Or he was a Nazi. But all right, be that as it may. In the book Being and Time, Heidegger says, look, the ultimate anxiety, and it is the unique purview of humans, is the realization that we're going to die. And what Heidegger says is that most of us react to that realization by engaging in what he calls a flight from death. And you're not necessarily conscious of this. But Heidegger's point is that most people recoil in horror at the prospect of dying, and that they essentially become culturally constructed meat puppets who live their lives in a
It's a
semi.
nice way to put it.
Yeah, they live their lives in a death-denying stupor by just accepting implicitly and explicitly the world as it is presented to them by their culture. In our world, they would just spend their lives drinking and shopping and maybe becoming political partisans in the US for Trump, let's say. Right? On the other hand, though, Heidegger says it doesn't have to be that way, that you can also, death anxiety could be a catalyst for bringing out the best in us. And the way he describes it, I'm finding quite compelling. He's like, you might become so anxious that you realize that you really are a culturally constructed meat puppet at times, that you're born in a time and place not of your choosing. Like, I'm a professor, but if I was born in a nomadic community in Mongolia, you know, you couldn't be a professor. I might be milking a goat and living in a yurt. And
you might be happier.
I might be happier. Yeah. And Heidegger's point is that I can't do anything about the historical circumstances and the cultural context in which I find myself. And yet, what I can realize is that regardless of my circumstances, I still have choices that I can make, and that some of those choices are a more direct reflection and expression of my genuine self than others. Even though this may seem naive, almost Mary Poppins-like in its optimism, it is when Heidegger says, if I can realize that, then in his language, that gives me a sense of anticipatory resoluteness. And so anticipatory is pretty clear. It just means that we look forward to the future. To be resolute, and I had to look up these words because I'm an ignorant American. To be resolute
makes me think of Bertrand Russell. He has like a quote. He calls it the zest for life.
Exactly.
I think that's also a nice way to put it.
I love that. And that's in The Function of the University. Whitehead uses that term also. And that's exactly what I love that. That let's use that. That we have a zest for life. We are we're looking forward. We are looking forward to living. And then what Heidegger says is that if you get into that state of mind, it does two things. On the interpersonal front, it makes us concerned about our fellow humans. I like that. And then as individuals, it gives us a sense that life is an ongoing adventure that we can embrace with, in Heidegger's language, unshakable joy. And to me, that gets back to the zest.
A nice wording. Yeah.
I love that, but I love the zest for life. And for me, that's what I find most uplifting. People are like, dude, you study death. You know, that's got to be a downer. And I'm like, no, actually, you know, in my finer moments, it's by thinking about death that I can get a keener appreciation for living.
It's like you're seeking for truth. It's like I have the same a bit with the podcast. It's just, it's nice to do this exercise of thinking about certain questions that you find interesting.
That's right.
But I think if you want to do it because you might become famous because you discovered a theory or you found an answer, I think that will not give happiness. But if you enjoy the process of doing it, whether it gives the fruits or not, I think that's the most important thing.
Well, I could not agree more.
I always think, I always find it hard between, you know, setting a goal or just following, just how do they, following the flow of the water and see where it takes you.
Yep.
What's your opinion about that? Because I think if you focus too much on a goal, then the moment you reach the goal, you will be happy for maybe 5 minutes and you will, you will need another goal. But then taking the other extreme and just going with the flow might not give you a lot of satisfaction because you don't have many success experiences. So I think that's like a difficult balance to make because, of course, you need to make money because you need to pay for food and shelter. So you need to be a little bit functional, but not in that extreme that you lose all the zest for what you're doing, I think so.
Yeah, so hold that thought because, again, I think it's about how do we get that sweet spot where we can have both of those processes operative. One of my favorite books by a dead guy yesteryear, the novelist Henry Miller, he wrote a book called Stand Still Like the Hummingbird, you know, which seems oxymoronic.
Okay.
But I like it because it's having it both ways. It is, you know, how do we carve out a life that is an ongoing dialectic between planned, intentional, goal-directed behavior that is complemented by the just ongoing appreciation of living in the present? There's got to be a balance that we can approximate.
Yeah, it's a difficult one for me. I think I'm not there yet.
Well, I'm not there yet either. There are some days I'll be like, I can't fucking waste my time walking the dog. I gotta finish this article that's gonna make us rich and famous. Mm-hmm. And then there's other days when I was like, fuck being rich and famous. I just had the best time walking my dog and watching him be delighted by simply being alive. And I think we need to be open
that
to both
brings
possibilities.
A lot of instant joy.
That's right.
I think the problem with setting goals sometimes is the moment you set a goal, you want something, and depending on your personality, like I have autism, for instance, which might make me a bit more prone to anxiety, but you immediately have something you want and you want things to go a certain way. And that's, it makes you insecure. It makes these mental processes come up that you don't really like about yourself. And if you just, I think if you just set internal goals, so maybe that's like the more stoic approach, like instead of saying, I want to, let's say you want to write a novel, I want to publish a book. Instead of setting that as a goal, you can say, I want to write the best story ever that I enjoy myself. I think
that's right.
That's a way of setting goals in which you don't condemn yourself to a lot of anxiety and insecurity.
Yes.
Because then what could happen is avoidance behavior, because you have this anxiety, you do nothing. And maybe it's the same with that in some way, that we have some avoidance behavior to not come to face with it.
Yes.
Yeah. What I wanted to ask is, so we have the corona pandemic now, which we are getting a bit used to. Do you think it teaches us something about how we as human beings relate to death?
Yes. But maybe not just one thing. I think what it teaches us is that people being people are surprisingly sometimes difficult to shake them from their daily habits and routines. And so, you know, some people, you know, we see the pandemic as like just a giant death reminder. And not surprisingly,
and the virus is not even that deadly, luckily.
No, so. It's not, luckily, but unluckily, because it is a potent reminder of death, it is arguably bringing out the worst of lots of people. So, you know, a lot of people are just drinking more, shopping more, watching television more. They're becoming more racist, more xenophobic, more devoted to populist leaders. And, you know, that's a bad thing. On the other hand, I think there's just as many people that the pandemic has given them an opportunity to pause, you know, in part because it's like, sit still. And some people are like, well, wait a minute, why am I doing this? Why is my life like being a human hamster on a wheel in a cage?
They might finally be interested in my podcast.
Yes. And I hope that there's more of that. I mean, one of my favorite sentences in a book is the last line of Albert Camus' book, The Plague, where he says, we learn in a time of pestilence that there's more to admire in humankind than to despise. And I'm like, all right, we're going to find out. I do think we're in a volatile moment in human history. And my sincere hope is that we realize, maybe again, this may sound naive, but the virus is everywhere. So too are our incoming environmental difficulties because of climate change. These are problems that cannot be managed effectively in national or individual isolation. And we're going to have to step up as humans and realize that we need to look at things from a radically different point of view. And maybe we need something as potentially daunting as a worldwide epidemic and economic collapse to shake us out of our comfortable stupor. I hope so.
Yeah, I think it's actually a good stressor, both for individuals, as for companies, as for the world, because if we're never under stress and the status quo, it's okay. It's not too good. It's not too bad. And we never change anything. And I think now maybe people will start to question if they want to go to an office every day, if they want to sit in a car 3 hours
Absolutely.
In a day, which is what a lot of people do in Belgium. We have the worst traffic jams in Europe, I think. So yeah, maybe like we said, there will be some more gratitude for the things that they now took for granted.
That's right.
Maybe a lot of relationships will also fall apart because if people people can always avoid each other if they have a busy life, but now if they're kind of condemned to be in the house together and work and live together, I don't know. I think there might be some relationships that come to an end. But maybe in the long term, that's for the better.
Yep.
I saw a fragment of you on the movie Planet of the Humans. I think the name was. I found it on YouTube. And you talked about a sustainable future. And I found it very interesting because you talked about how our lack of acceptance of death is really related to our how we're treating the planet. Could you maybe tell something more about that?
Yeah, sure. I'm certainly not the only one that harbors these notions, but there's a few things that environmentalists point out. One is that, and this goes back to a historian, a guy named Lynn White in the 1960s. He just said that, part of our problem with nature is that we don't consider ourselves to be a part of it, that in the ultimate act of death denial, we see ourselves in the Judeo-Christian tradition as created in God's image, and that are given the natural world for us to dominate and exploit. So Genesis says we have dominion over all that walks, flies, and crawls. And so one argument is that death anxiety makes us feel more comfortable as gods than as natural creatures. And this gives us license to exploit and despoil the natural environment. Then on top of that is the argument that death anxiety turns us into voracious consumers with insatiable desires for money and stuff. And what a lot of ecologists that I find compelling argue today is that you can't manage ecological crises without at the same time realizing how much of it is inextricably connected to conspicuous consumption. And so these problems are actually the same problem that we need to approach from different directions. You're not going to be able to fix the environment while maintaining an economic system based on unlimited growth in a universe of finite resources. And so that's the basic argument. It is just that we live in a world that is currently driven by death denial. That is what underlies the motivational impetus for conspicuous consumption. And there's no way that we can create a sustainable world without a radical overhaul of the way that we conduct ourselves economically, that in turn will require the realization by some that what underlies the infinite pursuit of money is the flight from death. Every other desire in nature has an upper limit that's bound to physical reality.
So like every noble goal that we have as humanity, in the end some people exploit it.
Yeah.
Money, and then they end up controlling the whole process, because in the end we are in a capitalistic society. So yeah, if you're calling the shots in that society, you can control anything you want.
There you go.
I sometimes think maybe humanity needs a really firm reminder of that. Maybe the corona pandemic will not be enough to make us awake as a society. Maybe the virus is not lethal enough in some way.
Yeah, I hope it's lethal enough for some, let's say, at least allegorically.
Yeah. Do you think that it's something genetic, that some people can go through life, like they can do their job without that much motivation? Some people can go through life quite easily, I think. They're quite okay. But some people really have like this existential urge for meaning in their life. Do you think that's something genetic, or is there any evidence to back that up? Or
to be silly but not, I think a case could be made for the genetic underpinnings of just about any human affectation, as long as we don't degenerate into simple-mindedness. So we're not implying here that there's a need for meaning gene per se. But yeah, I would argue that we do come into the world with particular predilections. And for example, some people are more prone to anxiety than others. And I don't see why it wouldn't follow from that there are some folks that come into the world with a genetically based predisposition to need for things to seem meaningful rather than to just take things as they are. But like anything, these genetic propensities would not be uniformly distributed amongst any population and would certainly interact with early experiences.
Yeah, I think when you talk about anxiety, I think sometimes we need the drama in our life, like we're a little bit addicted to having little problems to solve.
Of course.
Because if we don't, like, suppose you have zero problems and your life was perfect. It's a very stupid thing to say, but what would you do then? Then you would have to look into the deep emptiness that everything that's so wonderful will end. So I think we like to be distracted by making a mosquito into an elephant.
Absolutely.
In terms of problems.
Perfect. I like that. We used to, I can't remember what we called it 40 years ago, Stephen, but we used to talk about it and almost laugh about it, that we need the little problems to distract us from the major existential ones. I wasn't worried about, getting a shoelace or putting gas in my car, I might have to think about the fact that, overall, my life is relatively tragic and impoverished and meaningless. Yeah.
Yeah. What also find interesting is that despite that most of people tend to look away from that, is that then you have people who are suicidal and they look forward to it, or at least they think that everything will be better if they end it at all. I don't know what you think about that and how it relates to the rest of your work.
Well, suicide, that would take us another few hours, and that's if I knew what
Yeah,
I was talking
it's
about.
a difficult
Well,
topic, huh?
yeah,
Yeah.
it is a difficult topic, and there's some evidence that some folks who commit suicide honestly believe that there's going to be a better life thereafter. Some folks
Yeah,
who can
you have the fundamentalists again. Yeah.
precisely, and some folks openly admit that it's their fear of death. So there's a character in one of Dostoevsky's novels from The Possessed who says, "I'm going to kill myself because I'm so afraid of death that that's the only way that I can control it." So paradoxically, fear of death may have something to do with what underlies suicide, but I think it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I think yeah, it's something very, very complicated, but like you say, in the end, people want to change a certain future, or at least an assumption about the future, because nobody knows how the future will look like. And for some people, that might be the only solution that they see in their anxious frame of mind. Yeah, I think I already asked you a lot of questions.
Good. Well, this was great. I'm happy to talk again.
The end. Well, luckily not the end of You of Me, because that would be the very dramatic ending of an episode about death. But the end of this episode, and I hope it makes you think, because this podcast is all about allowing people to look at things they take for granted from another angle and to think on things themselves. It would also be very arrogant of me, like also Sheldon said, to even think that I would be able to give you any answers. So I hope you just enjoy it and it encourages you to think. And if it did, please know that it takes a lot of hours to make just one episode. And I want to make this a bit more professional. Maybe I can even add in a little fancy tune for you. And you can support me by just getting the word out to one or two friends who might like it. I know it sounds very cliche, but it really helps me a lot. And you can also make a donation on 20angles.com. So, yeah, I hope I hear or see you later. And you can get a good night's sleep now thinking about death. Bye bye.